Air pistols make little noise, only a whisper, followed by the soft of multi-barbed plastic darts. In the almost silent room, Johnny dove for the door as the rain of darts ticked into the wall behind him. He rolled through into the hallway. Shinji grabbed the burning paper and pulled it off the brazier. The severed hand came with it, and he tossed it aside as he beat out the flames. Too late. Only half the paper was left. One of the three images. The courier had escaped with one, and the other was lost in the fire. No matter. There were ways to retrieve data, even without the codes. The first step was to find the courier. Follow him! At Shinji's command, the two Yakuza sprinted out of the room into the hallway. Shinji knelt before the younger Vietnamese scientist.
Where's the courier going?
Shinji asked.
Where's he taking the data?
The young man summoned up all his courage and shook his head.
I can't tell you that.
Shinji rotated his thumb in front of the young man's face and smiled.
Oh, yes. I think you can.
Welcome to the Free City of Newark, said the sign over the customs entrance in 12 different languages. The 700 arriving passengers from the just-landed Beijing-Newark suborbital were all skeletons as they passed through the scanner, grinning skulls carried aloft on clacking bones. But wait, one of the skulls looked wrong.
Excuse me, sir.
Johnny's heart skipped a beat as he was stopped by the customs officer manning the scanner. Is there a problem? The officer showed Johnny his skeletal image. Inside the skull, a dark object rested, a robotic fetus in a cranial womb.
This implant.
Johnny smiled. It's all right. Government approved. Dyslexia prosthesis.
You have a permit, of course.
Of course. Johnny handed the officer a plastic card. The officer swiped the card through his machine and concentrated on the display. Johnny tried to ignore the vicious pounding headache that had been getting steadily worse the entire 4 hours of the flight.
Sir, here's your card back. It checks out okay, but there is a problem.
Problem?
The scanner shows a seepage. Looks like your implant may be disgorging. Better get it checked.
Thanks. Gracias.
Johnny hurried off down the corridor. It was a little girl's room. A pink and white powder puff of a room, hung with frilly curtains. The stuffed animals, the interactive dolls, everything in the room said joy, love, laughter, hope. Everything but the black-draped Shinto shrine in the center of the floor, and the man on the bed. He sat awkwardly, his expensively manicured hands resting on his knees. He was too big, too powerful. He looked out of place in the low, fluffy pink bed in his expensive Italian suit. But he was not thinking of himself or how he looked. He was thinking of his daughter, Mikio. Indeed, he was watching her. Mikio sat on the floor under a sun-flooded window in the corner, an 8-year-old girl with straight raven-black hair, wearing silk pajamas, a girl as delicate and beautiful as a ceremonial Japanese doll. Her voice rang clear and untroubled as she scolded her stuffed toy.
Now, Mop Mop, if you and Shirley can't play nicely, I'll have to separate you.
It was a happy scene, which made it all the more out of place that a tear was rolling down the hard face of the man on the bed. There was a knock at the door. The man picked up the remote that lay on the bed beside him and pointed it at the child in the corner. Suddenly, she was gone, along with her stuffed toy and the window that had shed its golden light upon her. The man set the remote back down on the bed.
Come in!
His secretary stuck her head in the door.
Sorry to disturb you, Mr. Takahashi, but...
I know, Mrs. Sutton. Shinji has arrived.
Takahashi's office was huge, as befit the head of North American operations for the Yakuza. He didn't offer his visitor a seat.
You look well enough, Shinji. Asia seems to agree with you.
He rested his gaze pointedly on the younger man's capped prosthetic thumb.
And I see you have found a way to turn your shame into an asset.
Before Shinji could respond, Takahashi continued.
I've seen the report from Tokyo. Pharmacombinat Industry of Zurich have engaged us to recover their missing data.
Shinji nodded.
Our operation in Beijing met with limited success. The Pharmacon traders are dead.
But the mnemonic courier escaped,
Takahashi said. Takahashi's tone was that of reproach.
With the data, he is coming here, to Newark, Shinji?
We have been given reason to believe so.
Why was I not informed of this fact at once?
I did not wish to disturb you in your grief, Takahashi-san. I assumed you are unavailable.
We are Yakuza, Shinji. I am always available.
What is the nature of the data we are to recover?
I have been charged with recovering the head of the mnemonic courier, cryogenically preserved.
Preserved?
Shinji nodded.
For the data, the defectors wiped the Pharmacom mainframe, then also destroyed the pirated CD-ROM. If we lose the courier, Pharmacom has lost the data forever.
Takahashi turned away. The situation was worse than he had thought. He turned back to face the younger Yakuza.
Newark is mine, Shinji. You were insolent when you trained here under me, and you are insolent still. You will report only to me, understand? If the mnemonic courier is in my territory, if you have not managed to lose him altogether, I will be responsible for the recovery of the data. I understand you managed to salvage at least one part of the courier's download code.
Only one of three images.
Better than nothing.
Takahashi held out his hand.
Give it to me.
Shinji pulled a singed, folded thermal paper from the inside pocket of his gray suit. Shinji handed the paper to Takahashi, executed the slightest of bows, and turned to leave. Takahashi waited until he was alone before unfolding the paper and spreading it onto his desk. It was charred on one side and sliced clean on the other. The image was from the Beijing Evening News of NAS rioters and police battling in the streets. He pressed a button on the vidphone on his desk, and his secretary's face appeared on the monitor.
Yes, sir, Mr. Takahashi?
Get me Carl Hoeing, Mrs. Sutton. The man they call Street Preacher. Church of Retransfiguration.
Some landscapes look bombed out, some are bombed out. Newark had the distinction of being both. The city had already been in ruins when the inner-city fighting heated up just after the turn of the century. In the succeeding decades, refugees from the fighting in New York and Philadelphia had moved in and taken over the shells of the buildings, patching together water, gas, and even bootleg electricity. Newark was a hellhole, or rather, a string of hellholes connected by shattered pavement and punctuated by skeletons of buildings. Johnny's head felt as if it were about to split. The howling of the taxi's long, dried-out shocks and the screams of its tortured springs reverberated agonizingly between his ears.
Hello?
Ralphie, it's me.
Ralphie came up on the dusty, stained screen set in the back of the front seat.
That you, Johnny boy?
Somewhere in Newark, heading for the delivery.
You feeling any better?
Johnny could hear the beat of retro disco behind Ralphie's voice, which meant the agent was calling from his office in a booth at the drone.
Worse. Much worse, Ralphie. I'm way overloaded, man. You wouldn't believe how much.
Johnny, you told me you got upgraded or I wouldn't have...
Yeah, whatever. I got the goods, Ralphie. I just want them out of my head. Fast. Did they get the download codes okay?
Don't worry, Johnny boy. They say they can extract easy with or without the codes. Delivery's confirmed. That means you get rid of the data.
Who is this they, Ralphie? What's going on, man? This is starting to feel like a blown deal to me. I don't even know who I'm dealing with, and I'm going to be completely exposed when I...
Johnny boy, has Ralphie ever let you down? I would have come with you, except I'm all tied up here at the office.
Johnny heard giggles and a faraway scream of hilarity or ecstasy.
All you have to do is get to the address I gave you. They'll take care of it from there. Look, just make the delivery, okay? Then come by the drone and we'll have a drink. Celebrate, Johnny boy.
Celebrate. Sure. Later.
Johnny hung up. He took the thermal paper from his pocket and stared at the single image as the taxi threaded its way through the potholes and between the ruined buildings, deeper and deeper into the heart of darkness that was 21st century Newark. Bye-bye, Johnny boy. Ralphie hung up the phone and looked around the Naugahyde booth that served as his office. He turned to the two bodyguards who sat with him in the booth.
Too bad about Johnny. Good kid.
The two shrugged in perfect unison.
I never liked him,
said one.
Me neither,
said the other. Your mama and Pretty didn't like anybody except each other, and they didn't like each other all that much. They had been man and woman once, though nobody except themselves could remember which had been the man and which the woman. Now they were both women. Ralphie's Amazon gladiator muscle. Yo mama was black, and Pretty was white. But they both had steroid spectacular biceps, V2 rocket breasts, and thighs twisted with muscle like bridge cables. There hadn't been enough meat left over for brains. Pretty and Yomama sat on either side of the little talent agent, flanking him in the booth. A man as well known and as little liked as Ralphie wouldn't last long in the drome without protective muscle. The strobe dance floor was filled, but it was hard to tell which of the patrons were swaying to the band, which were zoned out on wrecked drugs, and which were in the earlier, or later, stages of NAS. It might have been a scene from hell, if hell were a place people lined up to get into. At the bar, a young woman in a leather jacket was watching as Ralphie hung up on Johnny. She had been watching Ralphie all evening, all but ignoring the man standing next to her. He looked like a computer nerd on steroids, but there was a leaven of concern in the warm, brown eyes behind thick, horn-rimmed glasses.
About these episodes you've been having, Jane, I want to get you back to the shop for more tests. Hey, are you even listening to me?
No more tests, Spider. Jane was on her feet, walking away. A small, quick figure, in skin-tight black jeans and black leather, with short, spiked hair. As Jane walked towards Ralphie's booth, hands reached out to sample her as they would any attractive figure, male or female, who essayed through the meat market that was the drone's dance floor. Then the hands pulled back, without touching, for Jane seemed slightly dangerous. She walked like a fighter, with a menace and a strut that belied her size. She was just a few steps from Ralphie's booth when Pretty stood to ward off the half-pint intruder. But Jane caught the larger woman's shoulder, and using speed instead of strength, spun her off balance back down into the booth, where she hit the cushion with a woof. Jane's face was inches from Ralphie's, whose jaw had dropped open in surprise. Your hired muscle's aging on you, Ralphie. I could have done you. Time you hired somebody young. Somebody fast.
Why, you crazy little...
Yo mama hissed.
Street trash bitch!
Pretty finished. They started to their feet as one, but Ralphie held them back with a backhanded gesture. He was intrigued.
Somebody like you?
Yeah.
Have we met...
I know you, Ralphie. You're the agent for all the best combat artists in town. Well, I'm the fastest thing going now that Spider's jacked my system.
You're fast, huh? Let's see. Hold out your hand.
Jane held out her hand, palm up and then palm down, showing off the thin scarification lines almost like tattoos where Spider had gone in, regrouping and augmenting her tendons and nerves.
Well, just hold it steady. Right there.
Jane looked at him, a flash of alarm in her face. Ralphie smiled.
You can hold it steady, can't you?
Jane's hand was starting to tremble. Yomama and Pretty laughed in perfect unison.
You're damaged goods, baby,
said Yomama.
Yeah, like in another month or two, you'll be like her.
Pretty pointed to the bar, where a trembling victim of NAS was trying to raise her drink to her lips. It sloughed down the front of her silver dress. Ralphie stared coldly at Jane.
Sorry, but I can't use you.
Jane backed away, restraining her rage.
I'll get a gig, Ralphie.
Then she turned and walked away into the harsh, strobed beat of the crowded dance floor. High above the dark tangle that was the ruins of Newark, in the steel bones of a building whose skin had long ago crumbled into red dust, a lone figure moved, climbing, dropping, hanging, and strolling as casually on the naked steel beams across yawning chasms as if he were sauntering along a sidewalk on the ground. Far more casually, in fact, for this high, abandoned upper realm was his turf, uncontested. The figure was dressed in a layered costume of what might appear to untrained eyes as rags, but it was all carefully chosen for color and dramatic effect, decorated with beads, totems, trinkets, and colored scraps like flags. Around his waist, on an ancient army web belt, he carried a collection of tools dedicated to the arts of breaking and entering, repair and salvage, recycling and refurbishing. Over his shoulder was slung a spring-loaded crossbow, a postmodern melding of firearm and slingshot, an ingenious adaptation of found technology of the sort that had given his loose clan of lost boys their name, Lotex. He stopped at the end of a swaying steel I-beam and looked down. Though his origins, his accomplishments, and even his last name were shrouded in obscurity, his face was well known. He was J-Bone, the acknowledged leader of the Lotex, The media rebel whose face and taunts were familiar around the world, wherever he and his crew decided to momentarily hijack the airwaves and insert their subversive message of autonomy, anarchy, and freedom. J-Bone was anywhere from 18 to 30. He lifted a monocular from his belt and watched a cab drive up to the old paint factory. Johnny walked toward the factory, where he had been told his contact was waiting. His head was pounding. With each slow, deliberate step, he breathed in calmness, breathed out panic, breathed in alertness, breathed out ego. By the time he reached the entrance, he was as ready as he could make himself. First, he stuck a small device to the door frame with two-sided tape. He armed it. The blinking of its red, ready light was echoed by the smaller light on his belt. He knocked. The door opened suddenly, as if whoever was inside had been waiting with one hand on the knob. "You're Johnny?" Johnny stepped back. "You're the contact?" He didn't like the looks of it. The man who had opened the door was a punk with spiked blue hair, wearing razor-toed cowboy boots and brick and asphalt blend camouflage. The kind of freelance street muscle the Yakuza often picked up for dirty assignments.
"Sure hope so. Come on in."
The room had a faintly medical look, with a folding table spread with white plastic under a bright light. At one end of the table was a tray, filled with none-too-clean surgical tools, and a small cabinet with a handle on top, its glass door frosted with carbon dioxide mist. Johnny recognized it from his days looting organs from accident scenes and bootlegging them to donor banks. It was a cryo carryall, a cryogenic organ transporter. Johnny took one step back, and from the shadows, another man took one step forward. At first, Johnny thought it was the invisible man from the old movie. The man's entire face was swathed in white bandages, except for two holes containing tiny eyes and a long slit for a mouth. Johnny recognized him, or at least his upper Montclair High School ring. It was the man he had thrown through the glass into the shower stall in Beijing, Shinji's right-hand man, Henson. He was holding a chrome saw. His smile appeared through the bandages like an open wound.
"The doctor will see you now."
Johnny's hand brushed against the sender unit on his belt, and the door exploded inward, sending the punk into Henson. Johnny dove through the shattered doorframe into the night. He hid himself behind a pile of 55-gallon oil drums and peered out. Henson was in the doorway, screwing a laser-sighted device into a 7.62 automatic with a folding stock. He stepped out of the door, but before he could fire, the top of his head collapsed inward with a dull, wet sound like a ripe watermelon cracking open. He pitched forward into the mud. Behind him, swinging a 2x4, Johnny saw a man whose face looked vaguely familiar. "Who are you, anyway?" The man pointed toward the horizon, beyond the ruined skyscrapers, to an ancient iron drawbridge, festooned with cables and crammed with shacks and walkways like a giant insect nest.
"I'm J-Bone. I run heaven. Up there."
Sometimes, when the sorrow threatened to overwhelm him, Takahashi found he could assuage it a little by showing the video he had made almost 5 years before, of Makio building a sandcastle on the beach. But what was this? He had watched this video many times, and never before had he seen the figure now approaching across the sand. The woman was fully dressed. She was somewhere in her 40s or early 50s, European, Asian, or a little of each. Startlingly beautiful, dressed in a simple but elegant linen and silk business suit, walking in high heels across the sand, leaving no tracks behind her. Takahashi hit off. He tried fast forward. He tried reverse. The woman's face filled the wall screen. She was wearing striking yin and yang earrings. The woman looked at him as if she could see him.
"How sad, the loss of a child."
"Who are you? What are you?"
"I understand your loss. I have also experienced, in my own way, the loss of a child."
"You are an illusion. You are a hallucination."
"Of course. An illusion, like life itself. But let us hallucinate together, Takahashi. There is something I want to share with you. As an executive and as a parent, something you will understand."
"No! Get out of here! Leave me alone!"
"I was like you, Takahashi. I was you. Rigid, powerful. My will flashing like lightning between all the world's megacities. my name a cold wind in the corridors of power.
You are sent by my enemies.
The woman shook her head.
Say rather that I am sent by conscience, in the name of memory.
Memory?
Where I am, Takahashi, there is only memory. All is memory. Memory and the play of conscience. An endless reckoning of the score.
Hell?
The woman laughed.
You are in your own hell, Takahashi. Your purpose is lost. At the very center of all your power, there is only an emptiness. A hollowness carved in the shape of an absent child.
Suddenly she was gone. Makio was back. Or Makio's image. Playing on the beach. The men's room was empty. Ralphie stationed himself in front of the urinal, unzipped his pants, and suddenly he was grabbed from behind in a hammerlock.
They were waiting for me, Ralphie. Two of them. Yakuza. But you knew that. You set me up, didn't you? Friend. Johnny, it's not my fault. There's been a screw-up, but it's not my... Ow, man, you're hurting me.
I mean to hurt you. I'm gonna do worse than hurt you, Ralphie. Your ass is dead if you don't figure out a way to get this batch of product out of my head before... Thwack! Ralphie felt the grip relax as the voice went silent. He pulled free and turned, and saw Yomama standing over Johnny's crumpled body. She was holding a high-heeled pump in her hand. Ralphie groaned.
Not on the head. Tell me you didn't hit him on the head.
Ralphie bent down and checked Johnny's scalp. No blood, and he was still breathing.
Now let's get him into the back room, okay?
Yomama lifted Johnny as easily as if he had been a rag doll. Ralphie followed her out of the men's room, picking up Pretty on the way. Jane watched as Yomama carried Johnny into the back room, Ralphie and Pretty following. Then a gray-suited man got up from a nearby table and went into the back room too, closing the door behind them. He didn't bother to hide the Chinese-made Shensei broom handle 45 in his belt. Ralphie's head was hovering over Johnny like a bad planet.
Ralphie, what did they upload? The goddamn Library of Congress? My head feels like it's going to explode.
Ralphie almost managed to look embarrassed.
Your friend here tells me he can take care of that, Johnny.
Another face joined Ralphie's. It was Shinji. He was holding a Makita saber saw. Johnny tried to sit up, but he was held down by a leather strap around his arms and upper body. His legs were free, and he kicked them futilely.
Ralphie, you lying sack of shit! What am I supposed to do, Johnny? Argue with the Yakuza?
He steps aside so that Yomama could set what she was carrying onto the table beside Johnny's head. Craning his neck to look around, Johnny saw a cryo-carryall portable organ freezer. Exactly the size of his head.
Oh, shit! Can we talk about this?
Talk?
You didn't bother talking to Henson.
I have one image of the access code. You have the other two parts.
Look, let's download. I'll give you the data. Glad to get rid of it. Look, everybody'll be happy.
Shinji tried the saw.
You don't understand. We only have one, and our clients don't just want the data anyway. They want everything it's ever been stored in.
Yeah, but...
That way, there's less danger of information decay, and they won't have to worry about somebody going in later with an unraced nanobot or memory restorer. These days, you see, dead men can tell tales.
There's gotta be a way to work this out.
There is.
Shinji took a small blue rubber ball out of his pocket and jammed it into Johnny's mouth. He opened the little door on the cryo carryall. The air was icy cold on Johnny's face. A new and final kind of cool. From where Jane was perched, across two of the lightweight alumi-steel supports holding the cheap ceiling vent into place, it looked like an opening scene on her favorite real-life TV show, Operating Room. Except that the patient was wide awake, rolling his head from one side to another in silent panic. He had a blue rubber ball in his mouth. Jane didn't bother to think. Snap decisions were her forte. She drew her knees to her chest and dropped straight down into the vent, which gave way smoothly, giving her time to grab the T-frame for a swing and get her boots pointed dead center at the temple of the Yakuza with the ponytail and the whining saw.
What the fuck?
Ralphie saw Shinji go down hard. Pretty and Yomama both dived for the intruder, who had landed on her feet and was already spinning, drop-kicking Pretty backward into the door, where she hit with a sickening crack and slid to the floor. Yomama pulled a pearl-handled box cutter from the bosom of her low-cut dress. Jane pulled out her own weapon, concealed in her belt, a telescoping car antenna with a razor-sharp steel fang welded to the end. The blade bobbed like a fly rod over Yomama's face, centimeters from her heavily mascaraed eyes. Yomama was unimpressed. She held her box cutter at Johnny's jugular.
I'll slit his fucking throat, bitch!
So, the Yakuza was gonna cut his head off. Ralphie, mustering all his courage, stepped between the two women.
Jane, what say we pay you for a night's work and you just walk away, okay?
Jane folded the antenna.
$20,000.
Johnny groaned. He finally managed to spit out the blue ball.
I'll give you $50,000.
Don't listen to him, Jane. He's a dead man.
Johnny lashed out sideways with his foot and caught Ralphie precisely between the legs. Ralphie doubled over in agony, and as he did, Yomama dove for Jane with the box cutter. Jane flicked the antenna back out, then up, neatly severing three of the five major tendons in Yomama's wrist. Yomama howled in pain and rage, dropping the box cutter. Jane caught it before it hit the floor and sliced through the strap that bound Johnny's arms. Meanwhile, Shinji was on his knees, unscrewing the cap on his thumb. Johnny rolled off the table, hitting hands first, and heaved upward with his feet. The table flew across the room, catching Shinji in the side. Jane stepped to Johnny's side and they backed towards the door. One step, two. Johnny opened the door with one hand and let Jane through, then slipped through behind him. Just as he was slamming the door behind him, he heard the high singing sound of Shinji's filament cutting past his head. He ducked and fled, following Jane into the crowded dance floor. The building had once housed a movie theater, a Sony Super 12-plex. Then it had fallen into decline and had become a flea market. Then it had fallen still further. It had become a church. Above the marquee, a neon sign proudly announced, Church of the Retransfiguration. Inside the double doors of the sanctuary, the urine and Pepsi-stained seats were filled with mostly poor, mostly older men and women. Some of them were shivering, still wet from the storm outside that had brought them in to seek shelter. There was a movie screen at the front of the sanctuary. On it was projected an image of the crucifixion, inverted. Under the image on the screen, on the low, wide stage, a tall man with long white hair, wearing a burgundy robe, paced back and forth, clutching an inverted crucifix into which he chanted as if it were a microphone.
Some teach that these are the final days, but we have seen a new way, a new light. In this plague time, our goal is the image of the retransfiguration. Amen,
muttered the few in the crowd who were paying attention. The preacher let his purple robe fall open. Under it, he was naked except for silver-tipped cowboy boots and gold bikini briefs. His massive torso was scarred with the marks of implant surgery.
I stand before you naked in the house of God, whole and strong.
The preacher noticed the Yakuza operative entering the back door carrying an unfamiliar box and a familiar vidphone unit.
But now, I sense a need for meditation, brothers and sisters. Leave me now. The sermon is ended.